You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 127, The Liberators. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. Only a small fraction of the audience contributes to the show financially. But without you, none of this would be possible. Thank you for helping me keep this thing afloat. I'd also like to invite the rest of you to join us on Patreon. Our last patrons-only bonus episode included discussions of tattoos and the use of tobacco and other stimulants by Napoleonic soldiers. So if you're a real badass tattooed smoker, now would be the time to sign up. Anyway, we spent much of last episode discussing events in Great Britain. We last left Napoleon in the fall of 1809. The Emperor was on his way back to the capital after a few months in occupied Vienna, negotiating a punitive peace treaty with the Habsburgs. I'd like to start this episode with something that was going on concurrently with events we discussed last time, but we didn't have time to cover in the episode. The story of the Brunswick Ducal Field Corps. To properly introduce the corps, we have to go all the way back to the Battle of Auerstedt in 1806, where the Iron Marshal Louis-Nicolas de Vaux and 3rd Corps of the Grande Armée stood alone against the main Prussian field army, led by the Duke of Brunswick. The Duke was one of the most famous and respected European commanders of the previous generation. As you may recall, one reason the Prussians lost so convincingly at Auerstedt was that Brunswick was absent for most of the battle. He was struck in the eyes by a musket ball at an oblique angle, instantly blinding him. The Duke of Brunswick held on for nearly a month, but eventually succumbed to his wounds. Despite his long career in the Prussian military, the old Duke had never been a Prussian subject. In fact, he was the sovereign of not one, but two small independent states, the Principality of Brunswick-Wolfenbüttel and the Duchy of Brunswick-Lüneburg. That might sound a bit strange to modern ears, one man ruling over two different states with very similar names, while serving as a senior general in the military of a third state. But in the politically fractured Holy Roman Empire of the 18th century, this was nothing unusual. The famous Prussian military attracted talent from all over Germany and beyond. And besides, the two Brunswicks were small and enjoyed very close relations with Prussia, so the Duke never found his loyalties divided. Upon his death, all the old Duke's titles passed to his son, 34-year-old Frederick William. However, the new duke would have no lands to rule over. After Napoleon's victory over Prussia, both Brunswicks were annexed into the new Kingdom of Westphalia, the main French puppet state in northwestern Germany, ruled by King Hieronymus I, better known as Jerome Bonaparte, one of Napoleon's younger brothers. These two pieces of news hit the duke within the space of only a few months. First, the slow, painful death of his father, then the loss of his birthright and homeland. These two terrible blows took a severe personal toll on Frederick William. He sank into the black depths of depression and impotent rage. When he got a hold of himself, the Duke had one thing on his mind: revenge. Napoleon had taken almost everything from him, and the new duke was resolved to take back what he could, and in the process, inflict as much pain on the French as possible. Frederick William no longer had any state to use as a power base, but he was not without resources. Like many in the upper nobility, his family had property all over Europe. The duke mortgaged it all, and used the money to build a private army. He also petitioned the Austrian government for help. And as you might imagine, the idea of a German nobleman hell-bent on revenge against Napoleon was music to their ears. The Habsburgs gave the Duke uniforms, gear, and even weapons, and allowed him to operate freely in their territory. The uniforms and symbols of this private army were perhaps the most distinctive of any European military unit of this era. Pure black coats and pants, with accents in a bright, almost neon blue at the cuffs and collars. The men wore tall shakos on their heads, also all in black, topped with black horsehair plumes, the only color being a huge, bright silver skull and crossbones just above the forehead. Officially, this force was known by a somewhat dry name, the Brunswick Ducal Field Corps, but those distinctive uniforms quickly earned them a whole host of nicknames: the Black Horde, the Black Legion, the Crows, and the name by which they are usually known in English, the Black Brunswickers. Duke Frederick William himself wore the uniform at every opportunity, and soon came to be known as the Black Duke. Those black uniforms were meant to be a physical manifestation of the Duke's resolve to retake his birthright and get revenge on France. They made quite a splash. Those striking uniforms, and the dramatic story that went with them, quickly captured the imaginations of artists. There were never more than a few thousand black Brunswickers, but they have been the subject of hundreds of paintings and drawings right up until the present day. The core of the unit was men from Brunswick who had fled the region during and immediately after the French invasion, but they gathered recruits from all over Germany. Many of the officers were either Prussian subjects or veterans of the Prussian army, or both. In several past episodes, we discussed Austrian planning as they prepared for war against Napoleon in early 1809. As you might recall, the Habsburgs had hoped the war would take on the character of a pan-German crusade. You can probably see how the presence of the Black Duke and his corps on Habsburg soil might have fed into this idea. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given what he had experienced, the Duke often talked about his struggle against Napoleon in these types of lofty, proto-nationalist terms. He had managed to gather thousands of people around him who apparently shared his views, so maybe he really was onto something. In return for Habsburg assistance, the Duke promised to place the corps under Austrian command in the event of hostilities against France. As they prepared for war, the Austrians hoped the Black Brunswickers would be the first of many groups of patriotic German volunteers. We didn't have much cause to talk about the Brunswickers in our narrative of the fighting. The Duke had kept his word and placed the corps under Austrian command, but they had not fought on any of the three major fronts we talked about during our episodes on the war. The Austrians had believed, probably correctly, that the presence of the Black Brunswickers would have maximum propaganda impact in central Germany. But, as you may remember from our episode on the outbreak of war, they had decided not to make a major offensive in this theater. So the Black Duke and the Crows fought only in small-scale engagements. They performed reasonably well, but faced little serious opposition, and had no impact on the outcome of the war. The news of the ceasefire during the Battle of Znaim was another gut punch for the Duke. He and his men hadn't come within 100 miles of the homeland they dreamed of liberating. Now the fighting was apparently over, and his revenge against the French had amounted to nothing more than a few skirmishes. Frederick William had wanted to make Napoleon regret stealing his birthright. The emperor probably still didn't even know his name. As we've already seen, Frederick William was not the type of man to simply accept setbacks. The war between France and Austria might have been over, but the Black Duke hadn't signed any agreement with Bonaparte, and never would. The Duke addressed his officers, quote, "I am unwilling to bow before Napoleon, like the other princes of Germany," end quote. He then went on to state his intention to march into Napoleon's empire and, quote, "fight for the freedom and independence of the German nation," end quote. However, it was not at all clear how he might do this. When the ceasefire went into effect, the Black Brunswickers were right in the heart of Central Europe, near the Saxon-Bohemian border, roughly the same as the modern German Czech border. Obviously, now that the Austrians were seeking peace with France, they would not allow the Black Horde to continue operating in their territory, unless they too agreed to stop fighting. The Prussians may have been sympathetic to the Duke's cause, but they were also eager to preserve their neutrality. They would not risk angering Napoleon by giving safe haven to a private army sworn to fight against France. Every other nearby country was allied to Napoleon. The only hope to continue the struggle lay with a rumored British landing in northwestern Germany along the North Sea coast. At the nearest point, the North Sea was about 450 kilometers from the Black Brunswickers' position. That's about 280 miles. If the Black Duke marched his forces to the North Sea coast, every step of the way would be through hostile territory. Saxony, the small states of Napoleon's Confederation of the Rhine, and then Jerome Bonaparte's Kingdom of Westphalia. And they would be pinning all their hopes on a rumor. No one knew exactly where this landing was supposed to take place, or even if it would occur at all. Even if they somehow made it to the coast, the Black Horde might find themselves trapped with their backs to the sea, unable to link up with the British. Despite the risks, the Duke argued forcefully for this plan. He believed the people in this part of Germany were fed up with the French, and eager to see a restoration of the old order. He didn't think the Corps would be undertaking this journey alone, but with the help of thousands of average people. With a little luck, the presence of the Black Brunswickers might even trigger armed rebellions against Napoleon. Together, the Black Brunswickers, the British, and the people of northwestern Germany could open a new front and continue the war. That is, assuming everything went right. But that was a pretty big assumption. Some of the Corps' officers had misgivings. Obviously, this whole project was steeped in the Duke's personal feelings and emotions. One glance at the uniforms could tell you that. These men may have been true believers, but they were also professionals. They had joined up to fight for the cause, not to throw their lives away in some grand act of self-destruction. And to many of them, this was starting to sound more like a psychodrama than a military campaign. As the Black Duke prepared his forces for their march, some of these more cautious officers attempted to stir up a mutiny, but they got nowhere. By and large, the men of the Corps were ready to follow the Duke. Maybe this whole idea was madness, but if so, most of the Crows had the same disease. They would have some advantages. First and foremost, surprise. Nobody in the French leadership was even thinking about a small force of only a few thousand men fighting their way across Germany. As we saw last episode during our coverage of the Walcheren campaign, all of Napoleon's best troops were in Iberia or on the Danube. Not very many had been left behind to defend the heart of the empire, and they were mostly the dregs of the army. The Black Brunswickers began their march in mid-July 1809, only days after the ceasefire. Nobody on the French side even noticed until they crossed into the Kingdom of Westphalia at the end of the month. The Black Horde stormed the city of Halle, which was completely undefended. Imagine what a shock this must have been for the citizens. They believed the war was happening 100 miles away, and had just received word of the ceasefire. Then, suddenly, the streets were filled with strange soldiers wearing menacing black uniforms. Many of the residents warmed up to the invaders when they learned who they were. Some young men of the city joined the Corps. Along with fresh recruits, the Duke and his men were able to loot supplies and money from the city government. They also took the time to tear down symbols of the Westphalian puppet regime. It must have been exhilarating for the men of the Black Horde. They had been dreaming of this moment for 3 years. But they had no time to savor it. News of the capture of Halle spread quickly. As the Black Duke enjoyed his success, Jerome Bonaparte was already marshaling forces to stop him. The Westphalian military was only a few years old. Most of its troops, and even many of its junior officers, were raw recruits. The senior leadership were mostly experienced French officers, but as you might imagine, the French military had not sent its best men to lead a third-rate army that wasn't even expected to see combat. Still, at this point, there were probably about 2,000 men in the Black Horde. They were highly motivated and well-trained, but many of them had never seen a major battle. Jerome was mobilizing entire divisions to oppose them, and had already sent messages to the Dutch and the nearby states of the Confederation of the Rhine, asking them to send their forces as well. On July 29th, the Black Horde arrived outside the city of Halberstadt, and found it garrisoned by over 2,000 Westphalian regulars. They would have to neutralize this force if they hoped to continue their march to the coast, but Halberstadt still had its old medieval walls. This was a very tough position for a small force with only a handful of light cannon and no time to conduct a proper siege. The Westphalian commander seems not to have thought much of the Black Horde. He sent out a small force beyond the city walls to attack them, which was quickly beaten back with heavy casualties. The Crows pursued the survivors all the way back to the walls of Halberstadt, but the Westphalians were able to block the gates before the Brunswickers could enter the city. The men of the Black Horde knew they did not have time for a siege, and so they went to work trying to force their way through those gates. There was terrible bloodshed. The Westphalian troops up on the walls had a perfect vantage point to fire down on the men of the Black Horde. Hundreds were gunned down in the space of only a few minutes. It looked like the Duke's impetuous march would meet a tragic end under the walls of the city. But somehow, after only a short time, the Brunswickers managed to force two of the gates at almost the same moment. Black-clad soldiers began pouring into Halberstadt from two directions. To their credit, the Westphalians did not panic, but fell back into the city and took up new positions. There was hard urban fighting, but a Brunswicker hussar officer saw an opportunity for a surprise attack on the Westphalian headquarters, and managed to capture the city's military governor, along with several other senior officers. This convinced many of the Westphalian troops the battle was lost. They began laying down their arms. Isolated groups of Westphalian troops would continue holding out, but for all intents and purposes, another German city had fallen to the Black Brunswickers. It was an impressive, and honestly improbable, victory, but it had cost the Crows dearly. They suffered around 400 casualties. That might not sound like much compared to some of the huge battles we've covered lately. But remember, they had only started with around 2,000 men, so this was a significant blow. It was largely offset by new recruits. First, the men who had joined up in Halle, then another group in Halberstadt. But effectively, the corps had traded 400 well-trained and relatively experienced regular soldiers for 400 civilians. At its closest point, the North Sea was still over 200 kilometers away. That's about 130 miles. The hoped-for British landing had not materialized. There were Royal Navy ships active along the German coast, maintaining the blockade, and even conducting small-scale raids on German ports. But no sign of significant numbers of redcoats landing in a proper invasion. Linking up with the British would be far more difficult than the Black Duke had hoped. And of course, there had been no spontaneous nationalist uprising. The Black Brunswickers were very much alone and deep inside enemy territory. Despite their success, the march of the Black Horde was still facing very long odds. But at this point, what could they do but keep going and hope for the best? Next, the Brunswickers marched on the city of Brunswick itself, which fell without a fight. This must have been a bittersweet moment for Duke Frederick William. Brunswick had been his father's capital, As a young man, he had imagined himself ruling from this city. Ever since Napoleon annexed his territories, he had dreamed of re-entering Brunswick at the head of a liberating army. On the other hand, he had hoped to be greeted by his people, in arms, fighting to expel the French. It seems that, in reality, his subjects were not quite as enthusiastic as they had been in his fantasies. He also had no hope of actually holding the city. Brunswick was just another stop on the journey to the coast. The Black Horde could not afford to stay long. Once again, they looted the treasury and the armory, and picked up a small number of fresh recruits. They also took the time to rip the coat of arms of the Kingdom of Westphalia off of every public building. By now, the enemy was right on their heels. As the Crows occupied Brunswick, the advance units of an entire Westphalian division were already arriving on the outskirts of the city, led by an experienced French commander, General Jean-Jacques Roubel. By August 1st, about 5,000 Westphalian troops had taken up positions around the town of Ulpor, just outside Brunswick. The North Sea coast was still about 100 miles, or roughly 160 kilometers away, at a minimum. The Black Brunswickers would have to attack to get that division off their backs if they hoped to continue the march. The black-clad columns began advancing on Ulpor in the early afternoon of August 1st. They were charged by the Westphalian heavy cavalry, but brushed them aside relatively easily and prepared to launch their own attack on the main enemy position. There was heavy fighting. The Black Duke himself went down, but picked himself up a moment later. His horse had been killed, but Frederick William was unhurt and continued leading his men forward. Despite the ferocity of the attack, the inexperienced Westphalians held firm. They had the numbers. By now, they outnumbered the Brunswickers by about 2.5 to 1. The Black Duke had no choice but to order his men to fall back. This was a terrible blow. The chances of the Corps completing a 100-mile march with a superior enemy force right behind them would be essentially zero. The Black Duke marshaled all his forces for one last desperate attack. They would hit the Westphalian position at Ulpor again after dark. Hopefully, the confusion and chaos of a night attack would work in the Brunswickers' favor, and they could push the enemy back far enough to continue the march in the morning, on no sleep. As we've seen in past episodes, night operations were incredibly difficult to coordinate, and rarely worked out as the attackers hoped. But with their backs to the wall, what choice did the Crows have? However, after dusk, when the Brunswicker scouts began creeping forward, they found the village of Ulpor abandoned. Apparently, the hard fighting earlier in the day had convinced General Roubel that this position was overexposed, so he had ordered his men to fall back. The Black Duke and his men breathed a sigh of relief, rested in the city for a few hours, then departed on the next leg of their march. The way things worked out, the fighting at Ulpor would be their last serious challenge. General Roubel had badly misread the situation. None of his other units were properly positioned to stop the Brunswickers. Other German and Dutch units were advancing along their flanks, but with poor leadership, inexperienced troops, and little intelligence, they were unable to catch up to the Black Horde. On August 6th, there was a small skirmish at the town of Delmenhorst. This was a ruse. The Black Duke had left behind a rear guard with instructions to engage the Westphalians, then retreat north, to give the enemy the impression he was retreating in this direction, toward the port of Bremen. Instead, he took his force northwest, to the town of Elsfleet. The Westphalians took the bait. When the Black Horde arrived at Elsfleet, they had plenty of time to contact the Royal Navy. They were able to confirm that the rumored British landing had, in fact, been nothing but a rumor. However, the British were willing and able to evacuate the Corps to safety. By this point, there were only about 1,600 of them left, so this was actually not a huge challenge for the Royal Navy, who had plenty of experience with amphibious warfare. With the pursuing Imperial forces completely fooled, the officers of the Corps even had time to sell their horses before they boarded the ships. The Black Duke had saved his command. Those cautious officers who had tried to stop him had not been entirely wrong. The original plan, to open a new front of the war in northwestern Germany, had been an incredible long shot. The fact that he had even attempted it almost makes you question the Duke's sanity. The Corps had performed brilliantly, but without the almost inexplicable incompetence of the enemy, they almost certainly would have been destroyed. This fact was not lost on the French. King Jerome summoned General Roubel to the capital to answer for this fiasco. But Roubel never showed up. In fact, not even his own staff seemed to have any idea where he was. He resurfaced months later, in America. He knew he had made an unforgivably bad mistake, and decided to buy passage on a ship bound for the USA rather than face the consequences. The Black Duke had staked the success of his enterprise on the reaction of the German people. He believed support for his cause was strong. So strong, people would spontaneously take up arms if they only had a figurehead to rally around. In fact, the public response had been pretty tepid. Generally speaking, the Corps had been greeted with surprise, not joy. Several hundred young men had been inspired to put on the black jacket themselves, but there had been no uprisings, no general outpouring of support. Fortunately for the Black Brunswickers, it hadn't mattered. They had managed to slip away to safety anyway. It's easy to caricature the Duke's attitude, an out-of-touch aristocrat who was clearly dealing with some deep personal issues, who just assumed that regular people yearned to be ruled by him, and cared as much about his personal crusade as he did, just because they happened to be born in his father's domains. On the other hand, nobody had risen up to oppose the Duke either. Jerome's Kingdom of Westphalia was supposed to be a new type of state. A monarchy, yes, but a country by and for its citizens. The French had told themselves they were doing the people of Europe a favor by setting up these puppet states, sweeping away the corrupt and ineffective old order, and delivering justice and responsive governance. But when that new order was threatened by the very personification of the old system, the people the new order supposedly served were mostly ambivalent. The troops of the Westphalian army had mostly stayed loyal, but the public at large seemed not to care whether or not the state survived. And what about those young men who had volunteered for the Corps? Sure, there were only a few hundred of them. Perhaps you might write them off as simply adventurous or reckless, with no deeper ideological motivation. But there had been no similar movement of young men joining the opposing Westphalian forces. Even when the Duke's enterprise looked completely doomed, he had still been able to attract new followers. As we discussed last episode during our coverage of the assassination attempt against Napoleon, something was brewing in Germany. New values and new ideas about history, sovereignty, and identity, a mix that would eventually come to be called nationalism. In fact, it was brewing all over the Western world, but at this stage it was most evident in Germany. The Habsburgs and the Black Duke had been wrong to pin their hopes on a German patriotic uprising in 1809. But, with the benefit of hindsight, it's maybe more accurate to say that they were premature. The Black Duke may have been largely motivated by personal concerns, but he had tapped into something that was much bigger than his family's feudal holdings, or his personal grudge against Napoleon. In the preceding months, there had actually been similar incidents that had nothing to do with the Duke of Brunswick, or his personal grief over his father's death. These events had no real impact on the course of the war, so we skipped over them in our narrative. But they will have important implications for the rest of our story, so I'd like to discuss them now. As I mentioned earlier in this episode, Prussia had remained neutral in this war. Almost everyone in the country loathed Napoleon and sympathized with the coalition, but the country was still reeling from the disastrous defeats of 1806 and 7 and the harsh terms of the Treaty of Tilsit. Prussia had lost a great deal of money and territory. Its military and even its government had to be rebuilt almost from the ground up. They were in no condition to face the French again, however badly they may have wanted to. This was simple strategic reality, but some Prussians could not face it. They believed Napoleon was so menacing, and the wound to Prussia's honor was so great, that they had to do whatever they could to resist the French, whatever the cost, whatever the chances of success. This was a fight between good and evil. They felt they could not remain neutral, despite the government's orders. Some of these disaffected Prussians formed a patriotic secret society, which they gave a very lofty and grandiose name, the League of Virtue. The League was small, but it included many prominent people, senior aristocrats, intellectuals, politicians, civil servants, and especially military officers. It also attracted members from outside Prussia. They saw their cause as pan-German, something bigger than any individual state in the region, even the local superpower, Prussia. The League even had members within the militaries of some pro-French puppet states. One of these, Colonel Wilhelm von Dernburg of the Westphalian Army, turned traitor and tried to launch a rebellion against King Jerome in late April of 1809, only a few weeks after the outbreak of war between France and Austria. This is usually referred to as an uprising, but it was actually more of a coup attempt. Dernburg hoped to seize control of the Westphalian capital of Kassel, arrest King Jerome, and seize control of the state. Presumably, he would have then declared war on France, but things never got that far. The coup was not well planned. Many of those involved were civilian amateurs, not soldiers. A Westphalian officer loyal to King Jerome recalled fighting against Dernburg's rebels. Quote, "They came up the highway in dense bunches, not ordered but wildly disorganized, screaming and yelling and firing their guns in the air." End quote. They sound more like a mob than a military force. Apparently, one volley from the regulars was all it took to defeat and permanently disperse this particular group. There were 2 days of disturbances around Kassel, but the state was never seriously threatened. A few individual Westphalian troops deserted, but most remained loyal and put down the rebellion. Colonel Dernburg put on a disguise and fled to Habsburg territory. Only a few weeks later, another member of the League tried a different plan. Ferdinand von Schill was an officer in the Prussian army, stationed in the capital of Berlin. Schill was only a major, but he had a considerable reputation within the Prussian army. He had been one of their few heroes of the last war, helping to lead one of those Prussian garrisons that had stubbornly held out against the French after defeat was almost certain. He was awarded Prussia's highest military honor, the Pour le Mérite, better known by its informal nickname, the Blue Max. Schill was a very brave man and a talented soldier, but he had a somewhat excitable character and could be erratic. His newfound celebrity, the Blue Max, and his correspondence with fellow members of the League of Virtue seemed to have inflated his ego, to the point where he began to see himself as the savior of all Germany. In May of 1809, he was ready to make his move and begin the liberation of the country. Schill managed to convince his superiors to let him lead a small force of a few hundred men out of the city, supposedly to train and conduct maneuvers. Once they were away from their barracks, the major informed them, quote, "The moment has arrived, the favorable time, when you can avenge the fatherland's oppression and shame against the hated foe. Westphalia will be ready to rise up as soon as liberators show themselves." End quote. In fact, this was a mutiny. Schill aimed to lead his men against Napoleon, Prussian neutrality be damned. They marched into Westphalia and fought several skirmishes against the imperial forces. They were actually mostly successful, but it seems Westphalia was not quite as ready to rise up as Major Schill had believed. No rebellion materialized. With only a few hundred men, Schill couldn't hope to achieve much. He disengaged from the enemy and took his troops south, towards Saxony, to rest, gather supplies, and most importantly, find some fresh recruits. He had some success. Hundreds of men joined, some civilians and some Prussian soldiers from other units who were sympathetic to the cause. Many of these men were quite solid, particularly the deserters from the army, but many were not. One of Schill's officers lamented that many of the civilian recruits were, quote, "people of the most dubious morality, thrown together indiscriminately from all the nations of Europe, even prisons. The majority knew no other purpose but robbery and plunder," end quote. Not an encouraging sign, but Schill now had roughly 2,000 men under his command. Definitely not an army, but nothing to sneeze at. There is an old term in German for this type of semi-official military formation, Freikorps, meaning literally Free Corps. This force came to be known as Freikorps Schill after its commander. Once he'd gathered these new recruits, Schill marched north towards the Baltic to challenge the French again. Unfortunately for the men of Freikorps Schill, their long detour to the south had given their enemies plenty of time to raise the alarm and prepare a response. The corps made it to the Baltic coast, capturing the port city of Stralsund, but soon found themselves bottled up by an enemy force more than four times their size, mostly Danish and Dutch regulars, who were generally a bit more experienced, professional, and reliable than the Westphalian troops we've been discussing so far. Major Schill resolved to turn the city into a second Saragossa, referencing the almost unbelievable siege in Spain, which we discussed in episode 115. However, as some of you may have picked up on by now, Schill was prone to grandiose thinking. His Freikorps was not prepared for a siege. Stralsund was supposed to be just the first leg of an invasion of Westphalia, a preliminary base of operations, not the location for a decisive confrontation. They had little in the way of supplies, and, unlike at Saragossa, only limited support from the local people. Unlike the Black Brunswickers a few months later, they were not lucky enough to encounter Royal Navy ships patrolling the coast. On May 31, 1809, the Imperial cavalry outside Stralsund launched a surprise attack on one of the city's gates, and managed to force their way inside before the Freikorps men knew what hit them. Dutch and Danish horsemen poured into the streets, followed by white-jacketed Dutch infantry. Major Schill mounted his horse and led his cavalry forward in a counterattack. Outnumbered 4-1, the Freikorps had no hope of winning a street fight. If they didn't force the enemy back now, before they established a foothold inside the city, total defeat was almost inevitable. Unfortunately for the Freikorps, Major Schill went down almost immediately. Sources differ as to how. He was either shot by a Dutch infantryman or took a saber blow from a Danish cavalry trooper. In any case, it was a grievous wound. He fell to the cobblestones and quickly bled out. Major Ferdinand Schill was just 33 years old. Whatever small hope the counterattack had of pushing the enemy back died with Major Schill. What remained of the Freikorps busied themselves trying to escape. They were not members of any internationally recognized military. They knew there was a good chance they would be executed if captured. In the chaos of the attack, several hundred were successful, commandeering boats from the harbor to sail for Sweden, or slipping out of the city on foot and making the long, lonely walk back to Prussian territory. Several hundred were killed in the fighting, and over 500 were captured by the Dutch and Danes. The imperial authorities were actually lenient with the rank and file, but 11 Freikorps officers were indeed executed. Those who escaped to Prussia were punished as well, stripped of their ranks and honors, dishonorably discharged from the military, and imprisoned. As we discussed, those within the Prussian government may have sympathized with their cause, but the existence of the state depended on maintaining Prussian neutrality. They could not be seen as coddling men who had disobeyed their orders to wage a private war against France. However, once the heat died down, all these men were quietly pardoned. Many in the Prussian government felt the actions of Freikorps Schill had been hot-headed, maybe even stupid, but few objected on any moral level. As for Schill himself, the victorious Dutch forces cut off his head and brought it back to the Netherlands, where it was put on display in the public library of the city of Leiden. Proof that the major was dead, in case anyone tried to raise a rebellion in his name, and a warning to anyone who hoped to follow in his footsteps. The head was not returned to Germany until 1837, when it was finally given a respectful burial. Major Schill's mutiny had only lasted about a month, achieved basically nothing, and ended in failure. Just like Duke Frederick William of Brunswick and the hapless Colonel Wilhelm von Dernburg, he had believed his actions would be the spark that inspired the common people to rise up against foreign oppression, but had been sorely disappointed. He had attracted a few supporters, but nothing even approaching a general uprising had ever materialized. He hadn't even managed to convince many of the people of Stralsund to lift a finger to defend their own city. In the end, this so-called Second Saragossa hadn't even held out a week. The imperial forces only lost about 200 men retaking the city, not much more than a skirmish in the grand scheme of things. But despite their failure, Major Schill and the men of the Freikorps had written themselves into legend. In the days and weeks following the Battle of Stralsund, pamphlets and posters appeared all over Germany, extolling Schill and his soldiers as true German heroes, men who had the guts to attempt what others only dreamed of. Once again, although there had been no general anti-French uprising, the people hadn't risen up to oppose the Freikorps either. By and large, the people of Germany did not seem willing to risk their lives to resist the French. But most of them were not willing to defend their new French-backed government either. Perhaps that meant they were persuadable. Even failed rebellions sometimes succeed at galvanizing public opinion in support of their cause. I'm reminded of the Easter Rising in Ireland in 1916, which was crushed by the British Army in just 6 days. But led directly to Irish independence only 5 years later. History is full of similar examples. Sometimes it is only in the aftermath of these events that people find themselves wishing things had turned out differently. Sometimes they resolve to behave differently the next time a rebellion rises up. Would that be the case in Germany? Only time would tell. With the war in Central Europe now over, the opportunity for a German rebellion against France had passed, at least for the moment. But those proto-nationalist ideas were still percolating under the surface. As you've seen in this episode, German nationalism was still very much on the fringe, the province of dreamers, eccentrics, and bold adventurers. But that's often the case with new ideas. These types of people tend to be early adopters when it comes to political and intellectual trends. At this stage, it was pretty easy to write them off as a small handful of cranks, with no base of support among the general public. Perhaps that was even true. But almost every big new idea starts small. Sometimes today's cranks are tomorrow's prophets. The cause had yet to achieve much tangible success, but it was already building a pantheon of heroes. The martyrs Ferdinand von Schill and Andreas Hofer, and the Black Duke and Colonel Wilhelm von Dernburg, both of whom had openly defied the French and lived to fight another day. In fact, the Black Brunswickers would soon be back in action. The Royal Navy brought the corps to the British-controlled island of Heligoland in the North Sea, then back to England, where they would rest, regroup, resupply, and gather more recruits before being sent to Iberia to continue the fight against France. Which is a perfect segue, because we are long overdue for an update on the situation in Spain and Portugal. The last event we covered in this theater was the Battle of La Coruña, fought on January 16, 1809. The last event we covered in the main narrative was the signing of the Treaty of Schönbrunn, ending the War of the Fifth Coalition on October 14, 1809. Meaning we have to catch up on nearly 10 months of struggle in Iberia. When Napoleon left Spain in early 1809, he believed the fighting in this theater would soon come to a close. All five of the main Spanish Patriot field armies had been defeated in major battles. Several had been practically destroyed, and the rest seemed unlikely to be capable of operations anytime soon. The small British army under Sir John Moore had been forced to flee the peninsula, and Sir John himself was dead. The Portuguese had managed to raise a few volunteer regiments, but still had no real army to speak of. Most of western, northern, and central Spain were back under French occupation, including Madrid, not only the capital, but probably the most important strategic location in the country. Under these circumstances, you can see how the emperor might have thought the hard part of this war was over, that all that remained was to fan out across the peninsula and complete the occupation. By this point in our story, Napoleon and his senior generals had seen a lot of wars, and this is how basically all of them had worked. Destroy the enemy armies, occupy the capital, and maybe a few other major cities or important fortifications, and the government has no choice but to sue for peace. But the situation in Iberia was different. In Spain, the French were not facing a single centralized government, but a coalition of local and regional juntas. This was a spread-out, sparsely populated country, and with the juntas running things, Spain now had a very spread-out and decentralized government to match. We've seen in past episodes how the governments of the juntas lacked many of the strengths of a modern centralized European state. But they lacked some of its weaknesses, too. It is hard to land a true knockout blow on a state that has no single center of authority. Despite the horrible setbacks they had suffered in late 1808 and early 1809, the Spanish patriots did have the means to continue the fight, as long as the people were willing to follow. And, by and large, the people of Spain were still very much behind the war effort. As I've mentioned in past episodes, many average Spaniards saw resistance to the French as a holy crusade. It would take more than a few battlefield defeats to change their minds. You can say much the same thing about the Portuguese. There was also the fact that the Portuguese government and royal family were still free, and, in fact, still legally on Portuguese soil in Brazil, which created a natural rallying point for resistance. Bonaparte was used to waging wars in which the goal was to put pressure on a centralized absolute monarchy until it couldn't afford to continue fighting. The war in Iberia was fundamentally different. France was facing entire societies, not just one government and its armies. The Spanish and Portuguese resistance was, in some ways, quite dysfunctional, but it was also very resilient. Victory in Iberia was much further out of reach than Napoleon envisioned. And not only for these deep structural reasons, there were also a lot of practical barriers to French success. We've discussed many of these in past episodes: poor infrastructure, rough terrain, lack of food to forage, poor quality second-line troops and officers, a hostile population, and constant harassment by the guerrillas. Maneuvers slowed to a crawl in this environment. Any force bigger than an army corps often struggled to feed itself if it strayed too far from its supply depots. Coordinating the movements of different units scattered across large areas was practically impossible. In many episodes, we've discussed the strengths of the French military, their ability to move quickly and execute complicated and surprising maneuvers on campaign, the quality and high morale of their troops and officers, and their ability to keep themselves fed and supplied, even deep in enemy territory. These were the advantages that had allowed them to stay ahead of their rivals for over a decade, and all of them were blunted in Spain. The French forces in Iberia were in an environment that favored smaller, more nimble formations, and their objective was stamping out a decentralized resistance. And so they found themselves operating in much smaller groups than their comrades on the Danube. While Napoleon was wielding an army of well over 100,000 men, the marshals and generals in Spain were often launching operations with forces smaller than a single corps of the Grande Armée. And so, for all these reasons, this phase of the war in Iberia saw a lot of scattered, small-scale fighting. We will be focusing on some of the most important and colorful hotspots, but you should keep in the back of your mind that there was fighting going on almost all over the peninsula. Usually it followed the same pattern we've seen in past episodes. The Spanish forces suffered from a lack of experience and organization. They were often poorly led, and were typically unable to stand up to the French in a straight-up fight. However, French victories were often incomplete and almost never decisive. Amazingly, after all the stunning defeats of late 1808 and early 1809, Patriot forces in central Spain immediately began preparing a new offensive. Napoleon had taken the bulk of French forces in this region northwest to chase Sir John Moore through the mountains, as described in episode 119. Fewer than 10,000 imperial troops had been left behind to hold Madrid. Spanish forces in the region were not in great shape. Many units had been present at the Battle of Tudela, where discord among the Spanish leadership led to a complete disaster, ending with 6,000 Spaniards killed, wounded, or captured, and many of the survivors in very poor condition. However, the local Spanish commander in this region, the Duke of the Infantado, did have about 20,000 men left in good order. With Napoleon distracted and the Madrid garrison so weak, he couldn't resist making an attempt to retake the capital. That might sound a bit reckless, but the offensive started well. The Patriots easily brushed aside a French garrison at the town of Tarancón, taking them completely by surprise and nearly capturing the entire brigade. The French had not been expecting their enemies to retake the offensive so soon. The Duke and his small army were now about 85 kilometers from Madrid. That's a little over 50 miles. News of the Patriot advance set off a panic in the capital. The members of King Joseph Bonaparte's collaborationist government had only recently returned. Now, once again, they fled the city as fast as they could. If the Patriots could move on Madrid quickly, they might stand a chance at another surprising victory. Unfortunately for them, this ragtag army was not really capable of moving quickly. The Duke of the Infantado detached a vanguard of about 12,000 of his best men, under General Francisco Venegas, to make a thrust on the city as fast as possible. But by the time they got moving, the French had already brought up reinforcements and launched a counteroffensive. Marshal Claude Victor was on his way southwest from Madrid with around 16,000 soldiers. They met the Spanish vanguard at the town of Uclés on January 13th. The French had the numerical advantage, and so they were able to deploy their forces in a very long line. We've seen this before in other battles. This was a way for the larger force to press their advantage. A long line allowed them to menace both enemy flanks as they advanced, ideally achieving the coveted double envelopment and surrounding the enemy from two sides. General Venegas decided to extend his own line to match the French, which meant the Spanish would be fighting in a very thin line with no reserves, breaking a cardinal rule of Napoleonic warfare. If the French were able to break through that line in just one place, there would be no one to plug the gap. Many of the Patriot troops were inexperienced and unsteady. They only had 4 cannons to provide artillery support. The results were predictable. Marshal Victor started his attack on the enemy left. Without reserves, Venegas had to pull units out of his center and right to reinforce the left. This took time, and when those units finally arrived, it was far too late. The entire Patriot left had been routed. And that is why Napoleonic generals always kept a reserve. Victor now ordered a general advance, with the Spanish center and right weakened and French troops pouring through the left. The Patriot force disintegrated. Victor had sent one of his divisions to attack the enemy right flank, but they had either gotten lost or misunderstood their orders, and took too wide of a turn as they approached the enemy position. This actually wound up working perfectly for the French. The division appeared behind the Patriots just as the army began to rout. The Battle of Uclés was yet another disaster for the Spanish. In the space of only a few minutes, General Venegas had lost over half his command, 2,000 killed or wounded, and another 5,000 captured. Marshal Victor only lost about 200 men. In celebration of their victory, the French sacked Uclés. Sadly, sacking a captured enemy town after a battle was not unusual in this period. But at Uclés, the French behaved with particular brutality, killing dozens of civilians. The remains of General Venegas' vanguard fled to the south, chased by Victor's cavalry. Many more were killed or captured in the pursuit. The Spanish prisoners were formed into a column and marched back to Madrid. Word spread among their French captors that many of these men had taken part in the fighting at Bailén. As we discussed in our coverage of that battle, the French prisoners taken that day were treated terribly. Many had died in Spanish custody. It seems many French soldiers decided the prisoners they had taken at Uclés had to pay the price for what had happened at Bailén. They were barbaric, beating and abusing the prisoners, and denying them food and water. All stragglers were summarily shot, to the tune of about 30 men a day. All war is ugly, but the fighting in Iberia during the Napoleonic Wars took on a nastiness we do not see on other fronts, perhaps only surpassed by the colonial warfare in Haiti. With central Spain firmly under French control, Marshal Victor would be ordered south to finally secure this region of the country, which had eluded the French since Bailén. By now, Marshal Victor's name was ringing out across Spain, and not for his skills as a commander or administrator. He was becoming infamous as a butcher and a sadist. We don't have much evidence for the marshal himself ordering atrocities, but there is little question that troops under his command were becoming accustomed to breaking the unwritten rules of war. Taking vengeance on Spanish prisoners, and even civilians, however and whenever they saw fit. Victor and his officers had done little to restrain them. If we could ask the French soldiers who participated in these crimes what they were doing, they would probably say they were merely responding to the barbarity of the Spanish. Of course, if you follow the tit-for-tat chain of atrocities back to the source, the original crime was Bonaparte's invasion. The French never should have been there in the first place, and so they must bear at least some of the responsibility for all that followed. In this episode, we've seen nothing but French victories. The closest thing to a success for the coalition was the evacuation of the Black Brunswickers, which was certainly an amazing achievement, but a pretty poor consolation prize compared to what the Black Duke had set out to achieve. Napoleon had just broken up yet another coalition and enforced yet another punitive treaty on a hostile power. His forces continued to achieve success on battlefields all over Europe against all kinds of enemies. And yet, it's hard to look at the strategic picture in mid-1809 and say things were going well for the French. True, they continued to crush Spanish Patriot armies, but the war in Spain was supposed to be wrapping up. There weren't supposed to be any more Patriot armies left to crush. And yet, French forces were still finding themselves fighting full-scale battles. The French had won easy victories against all their enemies in Germany. But once again, if everything had been going according to plan, there wouldn't have been any fighting in Germany. In the wake of the Treaty of Tilsit, we discussed the idea of tying up loose ends. Once he secured the friendship of Emperor Alexander, Napoleon had felt the final victory was very close at hand. All that remained was to resolve a few outstanding issues, by force if necessary. Then all of Europe would be ready to move forward together under the Emperor's new order. By the summer of 1809, it had been 2 years since Tilsit. The war did not seem to be winding down. In fact, time and again, we've seen new hotspots emerge. Even inside the empire, Napoleon's enemies continued to grow bolder by the day. As we'll discuss next episode, the British had already reestablished themselves in Iberia and were working with the Spanish and Portuguese more closely than ever. It seemed the French military still enjoyed superiority over all its enemies. But how long could this go on? The collapse of the old order had brought chaos to almost every corner of the continent. So far, it seemed not even Napoleon was capable of mastering the chaos. That's all for now. Next episode, we'll continue getting caught up on the war in Iberia. For those of you who are signed up on Patreon, I'll be back to you in a few weeks with another bonus episode. Don't forget to get in your questions in the comment section of the last bonus episode. I'd also like to take the opportunity to thank those of you who have supported the show in other ways. Recommending The Age of Napoleon on social media is a huge help. According to the experts, this is actually the number one way people find new podcasts to listen to. So, those of you who have shared the show on your network of choice have done a better job than any marketing department could. Thank you. I'd also like to thank those of you who have left a review of the show on iTunes or other podcast platforms. These also help people find the show. Finally, thank you to those of you who have sent me money on Venmo. I have looked into it, and unfortunately there is no way to grant you guys access to the bonus episodes. Perhaps understandably, Patreon is pretty strict about only doing things through their platform. But I do appreciate the support, and that is an option to any of you who want to contribute financially but don't want to go through Patreon for whatever reason. Anyway, that's all for now. As always, thanks for listening.